This is Catherine Hastings, and you're listening to Word Temple on KRCB 91.1 FM. Tonight's program is going to be the recording of a very special evening at the Word Temple Poetry Series on May 16th, 2015. Three poets read that night. Local poet Maya Khosla, K-H-O-S-L-A, who's the author of Keelbone. Robert Thomas, who was celebrating his new book, Bridge, published by BOA Editions. And Malachi Black, who was at Word Temple to read from his book, Storm Toward Morning, published by Copper Canyon Press. I won't have time to air the complete evening, but I will put in as much as I can here, and you are sure to enjoy it. So stay tuned, and here we go to the Word Temple Poetry Series. Welcome. I'm Catherine Hastings. Welcome back to the Word Temple Poetry Series. It's nice to see everybody here. It gets a little harder and harder the closer we get to summer to have people come indoors. So I'm grateful for all of you tonight. You won't be disappointed. We have three very wonderful poets and writers reading here tonight. Maya Khosla, Robert Thomas, and Malachi Black. And we are going to begin, as always, with our opening poet, our local poet, and that is Maya Khosla. And she is not only a writer and a poet, but she's also a wildlife biologist who brings her experiences to her writing and does so very, very well. Her poems have appeared in many journals and are collected in her book of poems called Keelbone, which she has here tonight. That book won a Dorothy Brunsman Award, was nominated for a number of pushcart prizes by World Literature Today, and was featured in films, including Village of Dust, City of Water, that won a Lion Award at the Wildlife Asian Film Festival. Two awards from the Save Our Seas Foundation gave her a chance to document sea turtles of India and to work her poems into the screenwriting. Really wonderful work. She plans to film and write about saving rare woodpeckers at the Sierra Nevadas, and with rewards from the Audubon Society in Patagonia. As a matter of fact, she's taking off pretty soon now to head up to the Sierras, so we're really lucky to have her here tonight. Please welcome Maya Khosla. Climate as changed air and constant sun. It is an old story of borrowing and being unable to return, drinking itself away into salt. Time, the cactus's long-held barrel of water, running low. Wine and coral flames of sky pressed down by nights growing thicker with smoke. What went astray, as unfathomable as denial, and devoid of air. The vessel, ours, falling short of its escape velocity. The carbon dioxide meter in Mauna Kea, rising and rising. The held surf perch, so stressed, she relinquishes hold of her young. Six fish born in the palm of a hand. Black ice in metamorphosis, clicking and chiming. How submarines shatter into arrows, the opposite of falling. If such moments were all we had, if this light firing up the understory was final, what have we known of ice and glass waters, the intersection of breath and tropical silence? Of permafrost made temporary, of kingfisher blue and rain-soaked glitterings of salmonberry gone. Now the sea lions, arriving in droves, dragging the drum of hope between them, eyes widened by their own begging. The borrowed, never returned, asking, what more could be wanted? The token climate change poem. And I want to dedicate one poem against a rough draft, but it's
dedicated to the idea that forest fires are not destructive. In fact, they're a lot of rebirth, which is something I'm myself learning in the field. Montane forest renewed by fire. The lit and crackling world, not all gone to ash. Knots of pine cones thrown open by ephemeral flowers of heat, 5 stories high. After lightning has rushed down a staircase of its own thirsty making, after a cappellas of flame have swept through, the fiddleheads nudge out through ceilings of charred grass knobs, cones ready for rebirth, under the scent of smoke that seeps into crevices. The gathering of giants is solemn and black, sharpening their outstretched stillnesses. Even the crown tips far above, soon vigorous with needles of green. See the way heat has shaped sweet strings of sunlight. So they strum the high tops first, turning still wishes into sugars of growth. Wind sending out word. We lift the season's hands close to my face to receive answers from silenced forests. We'll carve them. Rivers of birds riding rivers of insects, who ride into the flow of smoke, towards the source between meadow and boreal. What do they crave? Anythings, blackened and alive. Anythings belonging to the wide open arches between torched light and after. Sapsucker, pileated, black-backed woodpeckers, pleading in the language of nomadic tribes. Dispersal. Oak crickets dedicate their shrilling to the stars. Tireless desire pitched into the jeweled universe with the most power a chorus of cells can muster. Can they move an escapee far enough from crowds who force-fed a man petroleum before lighting up his beliefs with a match? After the water is filtered, the tent pegs fastened, the fruit sliced, the valley stilled, I enter this world of oaks, one mouthful at a time. Relief. Up along its rim, the lapping grasses are lighter for the absence of prickly seed heads, quick released into my socks as I passed. The crickets' single-pitched surges are as rooted to the core, as native to the multi-million nuclei in each being, as the fledgling dread of a falcon preparing for first flight. As an apple's thump on earth, kernels of yearning, seed in the double darkness of sugars and nitro's coat. All store formulae for longing and reaching with genetic perfection. All preserve themselves at a cost. Okay, there's my fourth poem, Parakeets. All night the lightning. Staircases through darkness, torching the wide basement of oaks. Awakening from a long drink of sleep, the birds unlock their arboreal world and lift. Opening the sky, rain grays rinse the half sun. Their calls are one voice, their thoughts one thought. To circle the sub-cloud altitudes, arranging and rearranging the light. A whole mind swirling with green. Mass movement has one purpose, one ethos, and no room for argument. Nothing less would be resolute enough to lace through currents whose forces pull across whole continents. After the thick chains of gold have dropped, the birds spiral down. Swish of arrival echoing through leaves. Hunger is the only gravity that binds them to the milk sap and fiber of earth, to the business of cracking open the sun, and picking apart each seed of light with sharpened nutcracker beaks. Thank you very much.
We're going to move on to our next poet and writer, who is Robert Thomas. He is celebrating his latest book, which is called Bridge. It is a work of poetic fiction, I'm going to call it, published by BOA Editions. And I'll get back to that book in just a minute. His first book of poems is called Door to Door, and it was selected by Yusuf Kumaniaka as winner of the Poets Out Loud Prize. That's no easy feat. And it was published by Fordham University. His second book is called Dragging the Lake, and that was published by Carnegie Mellon. Thomas has received a poetry fellowship from the National Endowment for the Arts, and he's also won a Pushcart Prize. But going back to Bridge, which he's reading from tonight, it is set in modern-day San Francisco, so I like that right off the bat, and it looks very closely at all kinds of things. There is a very tumultuous life of a young woman in the book. There are real and hallucinated relationships. There is mental illness, murder, suicide, all kinds of juicy things, and more. So it's really a very unique book. One chapter begins, for instance, with the narrator comparing a handgun to an unborn child. It's something that you know is there. You can reach down and feel that it's there, but you don't really use it yet. The glory of Bridge, says Robin Black, is not in language alone. The story is gripping, the psychology surprising, and utterly right all at once. Tony Hoagland says, Bridge has the lucid, spacious interiority and intensity of Virginia Woolf's Mrs. Dalloway. I would be terrified if someone wrote that about my work. You'll have to tell us how you feel about that. Quite a compliment. And a prose style, hypnotic and brilliant enough to earn that comparison. His combination of sheer lyricism and incisive edginess in each swift poetic chapter keeps the reader leaning forward to hear what our wounded, brazen narrator is going to say next. So sit back and enjoy Robert Thomas.
Thank you, Catherine. That was a great introduction, and thank you for inviting me to read here. I'm really happy to be reading with both Maya and Malachi, and I will try to adjust my position to suit the microphone here. I hardly have to give an introduction. I'm going to read from this new book, Bridge. As Catherine mentioned, I originally called it a novel in prose poems. Now I'm just calling it a lyrical novella. But since this is primarily, some of the pieces in it are more towards the prose poem end of the spectrum, and some of them are more towards the traditional narrative fiction end of the spectrum. I'm going to read some more towards the prose poem end of the spectrum, since this is a poetry reading series primarily. As Catherine mentioned, the narrator is a young woman who lives in San Francisco, Alice. She's going through a tumultuous time at work. She has a difficult relationship with her supervisor, Fran. She has a difficult romantic relationship with a coworker, David, who's married. Jeanette is the name of his wife. In a section I'm going to read, she buys a gun. She thinks about killing someone, sometimes herself, sometimes Fran, sometimes David, sometimes who knows. And I guess that's about all you need to know. I'm going to start with some sections where actually she's remembering her childhood and as she's growing up. Asylum. I grew up on the coast in Pescadero, and I wanted to be a marine biologist. I thought it would be just me and a pencil in a red bathysphere, intimate and warm. I'd observe squid and sardines, their black clouds and silver wheels, and they'd be amazed by my nimble note-taking fingers. In fact, the last bathysphere must already have been preserved in the Smithsonian by the time I left home for college 15 years ago. Now they use a two-man vehicle, like Jacques Cousteau's Denise. I'm trying to explain what happened when everything began to go wrong. When I could solve differential equations, but I could no longer walk from my room to the library because the trees were growing. The redwoods had always been an asylum to me, but now their grace only reminded me of my awkwardness. When I looked at their perfect branches, it felt like the time I walked in on Caitlin, my roommate, one Sunday afternoon while her boyfriend was kissing her breasts, naked and shameless, and matter-of-fact as knees. And she looked at me with pity and contempt. It didn't matter if I looked like Cleopatra. She looked like Amy Winehouse. Even the books in the library were naked, which once had looked so beautiful with their buff and russet bindings stacked like layers of sandstone in a sea cliff. But I was the one who felt shame. I didn't need to work myself into a rubber suit and ride the Denise into the pink anemones of a coral reef to feel out of place. The faucet that jutted from the library's concrete wall was naked. The sequoia's roots simmering in the earth. Naked the egg white, naked the yolk, naked the olive and clover. Naked the old professor as he lectured on the null hypothesis. Naked the young biologist as she measured the kelp forests. Naked the seven lost psalms of Jonah. Naked the eight beatitudes. And naked the 70 times seven forgivenesses of water, none of them for me. The gift. My father gave me a rosewood chess set when I turned 12. I'd never felt so loved through and through, almost literally as if I were transparent. And it probably wasn't love, just a lucky last-minute guess at the toy store, which is probably what most love is anyway. I took it into my room, shut the door, and determined to master every fork and zugzwang, that position still strangely familiar to me now, where you'd be safe if only you didn't have to make a move. I'd given myself the perfect gift. When I got the box home, I let it sit on the kitchen table in its wax wrap for hours, safe from the elements, protected from rust. I imagined it at rest in its velvet sack next to the dainty box of bullets. I wouldn't need many, and no sequined wrapping paper could have been more beautiful than the brown sheet the clerk had unrolled and cut along the steel edge in one long, smooth stroke. When I finally slit through the layers to open it, the paper was as delicate and rich as sheets of pastry and baklava, but with a mass of dark chocolate in the center. I never touched one. I loved how perfectly its handle fit my hand, centuries of engineering and design coming together in the unit. And I knew it would work. Unlike toys, unlike religious rituals, erotic techniques, and works of art, I could depend on it. The only other device I owned that fulfilled its function so reliably was my reading glasses. And I used a soft gray cloth, just like the one I cleaned them with, to wipe the oil from my fingertips as I dropped the bullets one by one into the somber chambers. I just need to know it's there, like the extra purse I keep hidden in the closet with a money clip and a neatly folded change of clothes. I don't need a class in safety or marksmanship. If I ever use it, it will be at close range. It may be the only way to get rid of the stranger inside. It may be the only way to get inside someone I love when every other route has been barred. The lion's head. Here I am again on my garage sale sofa, the color of one of those overpriced trendy ice creams, plum jasmine, osso buco sorbet. I paid extra to have the guy deliver the sofa and carry it up the stairs, even though normally I'd rather walk down the street naked than have someone in my apartment see the leftover Thai takeout on my counter and the books on my shelf. See, I have books on my shelf. Dr. Frost said I was paranoid. But someone who sees the things in your home, it's as if they're scraping layers of paint off the inside of your skull and revealing the old wallpaper underneath, all the tiny sentimental roses. I've come to like my headquarters here in the evenings, looking out at the building across the piazza, all right, across the parking lot, imagining the lives inside. But it's no rear window. I've never seen as much as a blasé cat in those windows. At most, an oblong shape that might be a refrigerator in the shadows. What do I expect to see? In my experience, most people don't act out, as my doctor says, very often. Once I was walking down Judah Street after dark to get some vanilla wafers at the Korean grocery and caught a glimpse of a woman in a tan sweater in her living room. At the moment, a man touched her breast as she reached to turn off the lamp. I knew it was the first time he touched her that way. If it had happened before, they would have had an understanding. They would at least have already shut the blinds. It was probably the most erotic thing I've ever seen, and I've seen more than you'd think, especially in the hospital. The sound of a paper hospital gown being torn slowly in the dark, it's not something you forget. People don't act very often, so I remember that scene. People don't make scenes anymore. That seems to have been a pursuit our parents' generation exhausted, like swing music. Once my grandmother stood and walked out of a restaurant mid-dinner, leaving her short ribs to sulk in their Polynesian glaze, and took a cab home because my grandfather had called her sister a bimbo. While we kids watched and knew everyone else was watching too. People don't do that anymore. It's the great accomplishment of our generation. Our parents defeated Hitler. We stopped making scenes. What happened to words? Civilization depends upon people learning to say, "I spit on you," instead of spitting. Well, I spit on you, David, and Fran, and Dr. Frost, and the sofa guy, with all the force of a civilization that goes back 6,000 years, with all the force of the limestone of the Sphinx of Giza, the lion-limbed king who still keeps his secrets on the west bank of the Nile. I spit on you. The lion and I, we keep our own counsel. How many years did it take to haul the 100-ton stones into place in the desert? Making a scene. The head is disproportionately small. They say that 6,000 years ago it had the head of a lion, but a pharaoh hacked it away to replace it with his own likeness. Imagine the original lion. 10.5. Number of years I've lived in this apartment, 10.5. Number of visitors I've had, 10.5. The landlady, of course, Mrs. Gucci, no relation to the fashion designer. In fact, as far from a fashion designer as one can get, despite her obsession with her carpets. If I ever do it, one of my joys will be choosing a method that leaves a mess on the carpet. As far as I know, she's never entered the place after unlocking the door and looking anxiously at my boxes of books when I moved in. I enjoyed speculating on which word in the title of Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance made her the most antsy. There was no Zen involved in Mrs. Gucci's building maintenance, only her son Michael, short for Michelangelo. He was my second visitor. Michael found an excuse to visit about once a year, always wearing the same red, white, and blue headband. If the circuit breakers in the building broke or whatever it is they do and the power went out, It was an excuse for Michael to knock on my door and look around as if he suspected I slept on the couch so I could fill my bedroom with marijuana plants and circuit-busting grow lights. My parents haven't been here for years. But oh, they were here. They came bearing gifts. They brought me an alarm clock as a housewarming present. Actually a nice one I still use, one of those that looks like an old-fashioned radio. I have it tuned to the classical station, even though it seems like I'm woken up every morning by one of Vivaldi's Four Seasons. They also brought an enormous green salad with about a pound of celery, enough to live on for a week if you were lost in the woods, which I was not. That went down the garbage disposal as soon as they left. Who brings a salad as a housewarming gift? It required a visit from Michael to repair the disposal. Celery fibers are tough as fishing line. My sister and her boyfriend came when they were in the neighborhood once because they'd taken a tour of Alcatraz. I wasn't very hospitable, and my sister wasn't very, what's the word, hospiting? I can't blame her. She'd seen a lot. She'd seen me doing my algebra homework when I was 13 and we shared a room, and the bulb burned out in my desk lamp, and I unscrewed the bulb to replace it and lifted the lamp to make it easier. And when I grasped it, I put my thumb in the socket, and the jolt knocked me so hard I fell back in my chair to the floor. Our parents ran into the room from the kitchen where they'd been drying the dishes, and I was okay. I was fine. But my sister had seen the pause. She'd seen me pause before grasping the lamp, and she'd seen that I'd known what would happen. And in that pause, she'd seen how I looked at her. So they had a couple of glasses of water because they were hot from their Alcatraz tour, and they talked for a few minutes about how the inmates made their cells homey. A mirror, shoe polish, a harmonica, dime novels, crayons and papers if it was kindergarten. But then they returned their glasses to the kitchen and left. I don't know the names of my next two visitors, so I may as well call them 7 and 8. Or maybe Siete and Ocho, the Latino painters Mrs. Gucci sent to paint the place after I'd lived here 5 years. They did my whole apartment in one day. Siete came early in the morning, so I could let him in before I left for work. And even though Mrs. Gucci had picked out a generic off-white cafe latte, he painted a swath on the wall and told me if I didn't like it, he could use a different color, saffron or wintergreen, and Mrs. Gucci didn't need to know. I told him the white was fine. When I got home at the end of the day, Ocho was there too, and they were folding up their tarps, but still listening to the mariachi music they'd brought with them and playing it louder than I'd ever dared to play anything. Siete was in charge. I think he was Ocho's uncle, and he probably picked the music. It was kind of waltzy. For a second, I thought he was going to ask me to dance. For a second, I thought I'd say yes, but it didn't happen. Officers Jackson and Zapata might have been the alter egos of Siete and Ocho. There was no doubt that I'd remember their names. They escorted me home after picking me up at night on the Golden Gate Bridge, where I'd been standing at the rail looking down at the water. I hadn't climbed over the rail or anything. I wouldn't have been conspicuous if it had been light out. What I'd been thinking was not that I was Jesus when the devil tempted him to leap from the peak and let the angel save him. No, I was thinking that Jesus was like me. I was thinking he was just a very unhappy person, with no mystery to him at all. Did it occur to me that an angel in the form of a freak whirlwind might catch me before I struck the black water and hurl me like a shooting star across the sky? It did, and though I thought it unlikely, I laughed at myself out loud for a moment. So I had a twisted look on my face when the officers stopped their Crown Victoria on the bridge and asked me if everything was all right. Not just if I was all right, but everything. I was speechless. Think of everything that goes on in the world, in the universe, or just behind the front doors and bedroom doors and closet doors of just one city block. Then ask yourself if everything is all right and try to keep a straight face. Nevertheless, I liked the officers and got into the car without giving them any trouble. Officer Zapata was a woman, and the Division of Labor seemed to assign her the job of churning out empathy while Officer Jackson drove the car. And I had to admit she did it pretty well, mostly by passing me her French fries and keeping her mouth shut. It also didn't hurt that the back seat was 10 times more comfortable than the backstabbing bus seats I was used to.
You're listening to Word Temple on KRCB 91.1 FM. Let's return now to Robert Thomas reading from his book, Bridge.
By not trying too hard, I convinced them I was stable enough to go home, but their rules required them to take me there and actually see me into my apartment to make sure I didn't have an array of drugs or razors on my counter or a scary boyfriend or husband on the couch. And apparently I passed the test. The half-visitor, of course, was David. I'd been afraid he might invite me for dinner with him and Jeanette, maybe even do something nauseating like ask me to bring a friend. But he didn't, and I was grateful for that. He waited until Jeanette had left town for a weekend yoga retreat or something, and I mentioned I was going to an opera matinee, and he asked if I'd like to have an early dinner with him after the opera. I said yes. I didn't say, sure, that sounds like fun, or anything like that. I just quietly said yes, so he knew, and I knew. I had a burger, and he had some kind of highfalutin fish and chips, and he drove me home. He drove through the iron gate to the courtyard of my building, and there was no question of my asking him up, or even a kiss in his Corolla. There were only the few seconds when he looked at me and left my insides in a disarray in which the last shall be first and the dead shall be quenched and the elixir shall be mercury and cinnabar. And I did not look away, and he knew, and I knew.
Thank you. So we have one more poet to go. Malachi Black is here to celebrate his new book of poems, Storm Toward Morning, which was published by Copper Canyon Press. As I asked and answered in my email blast to you, what makes this book so interesting? For one thing, Storm Toward Morning is allowed a real nice freedom to move around freely in whatever the poem wants at hand. Sometimes it's a form, sometimes it's free verse. It's the opposite of hemming in a poem and telling it what it's going to be. So the emotions conveyed in the poems are equally unharnessed. This is a book that reflects reality in that way as anguish and joy and all kinds of emotions are felt side by side. Mark Jarman says, to be both visionary and accurate, true to physics and metaphysics at the same time, is rare and puts the poet in some rarefied company. Black, like a few other younger poets, is willing to include all this traditional effects of the lyric poem in his work, but he has set them going in new and lively ways, with a confidence of virtuosity and a belief in the ancient pleasures of pattern and repetition. Born in Boston, raised in Jersey, Black is a recent creative writing fellow in poetry at Emory University, a recipient of a Ruth Lilly Fellowship, as well as grants and awards from the Breadloaf Writers Conference, the Fine Arts Center in Provincetown, the McDowell Colony, the Sewanee Writers Conference, and others. Right now, he is Assistant Professor of English and Creative Writing at the University of San Diego. So please give it up for Malachi Black.
Thank you, Catherine, very much for that warm introduction. And thanks to Maya and Robert both for those phenomenal, rich and enriching readings. It's a pleasure to be here. Of course, I thank you all for coming. I'm going to begin with a poem entitled, That the Bones Which Thou Hast Broken May Rejoice. It takes its title from Psalm 51. Born for the briar, Lord, my cheek, rounded as the unripe nectarine, but pliant as a moss grown over mud. Gorge on the salt fruit of the violet cord, vein lacing muscle to its unrepentant blood. I am the harvest, Lord, femur, rib, and clavicle, to be hollowed as the flute is for a song. Lift up my skull, the halved gourd, so the blank note of the wind can find its form. This next poem is perhaps the most academic poem I've ever written, so I ask your apologies, extend my apologies in advance. It's a poem of direct address to Marcus Aurelius, a man with whom I suspect we're all familiar. I'll say the only thing I think that really matters is that in the Meditations, which of course Aurelius wrote on the battlefront while he was sort of in his tent meditating on the virtues of Stoic life, he enjoins readers to aspire to the condition of the promontory against which the sea continually crashes, but which itself remains utterly unaffected by that pressure. A memo to the self-possessed. Caesar, I can see the blue breath of a meteor rake the naked vacancy of sky. An exhalation aching from the fate of Gemini for conflagration in the hazard of our atmosphere. The teeth of Earth burn with the friction of their gear, turning once and then again as mathematically the year painstakingly divides our tribulations. Here, and only here, the moisture in a sigh is equal to both fever bead and tear. The heart beats as an instrument of sciences unclear to its own monitors. Here, we try but find no foothold on an enormous sphere. We falter as the circus ball revolves, then disappear just after our first flatlined equilibrium. And where are you tonight, Marcus Aurelius? Are you as steady as the fulcrum, or were you just another victim of the lever? My bony liege, even heady Archimedes was dissevered by the seared blade of a siege. Not Aristotle nor his soft-wrought golden mean can buttress us against an iron sword's keen cut and thrust. Caught in our palpitating selves, we are furious machines. Caesar, I have seen the sea in shelves of foam, and I have known it as an ancestor. In this undertow of pulse, what solemn stroke do you propose? What stoic song can cool, can calm the meteoric note of my hot throat as it explodes? Insomnia and so on. Fat bed. Lick the black cat in my mouth each morning. Unfasten all the bones that make a head and let me rest. Unknown among the oboe-throated geese gone south to drop their down and sleep beside the outbound tides. Now there's no nighttime I can own that isn't anxious as a phone about to ring. Give me some doubt on loan. Give me a way to get away from what I know. I pace until the sun is in my window. I lie down. I'm a coal. I smolder to a bloodshot glow. Each day, I die down in my bed of snow, undone by my red mind and what it woke. Ode to the Sun. You repeat yourself like no one I know. Steadily somewhere, You roll unnoticeably forward, even now, showing. Your finger lifts the flowers and their faces by the chin, but you will leave them behind like blown-out beach umbrellas. You will always reach and extend. You will always try to keep me to yourself on Monday mornings. You will glare, and I will go, but you don't care, and you can't know. I will look at you too long and cry. I will wonder where you've gone at night. I'll fall asleep and dream an acorn. You are nothing but a breast, round behind a blouse of clouds built to be unbuttoned. You love, you share yourself, and you are always naked. You love, you show us how to take our places. You love, you cover our faces. Our Lady of Sorrows. What is it that she wanted? Each bird invisibly was harnessed like a tent peg to the tarpaulin of spring. Each sparrow, scarlet tanager, and starling bartered with the wind stream wing by wing to haul across the hemisphere a little portion of the sky to fit now, fixtured simply in the wintered planet of her eye. What is it that she wanted, if not spring? Sprigs broken into crocuses, a butterflying openness clothing the magnolias with a breeze. A troubling of the shrubbery, a fraught commotion of the honeybee, a wrinkling of sunlight through forsythia trees. All this is hers to hover in, to walk through and be covered in, to grieve. All this is sad extravagance, as only those who are not looking cannot see. Drifting at midday. Now I can see. Even the trees are tired. Their bones bent forward in a skin of wind, leaning in osteoporosis, reaching for a little more than any oxygen can give. When living is in season, they can live. But living is no reason to continue. Everything begins, and everything is desperate to extend, and everything is insufficient in the end, and everything is ending. Now I can see. Even the trees. I have forgotten you, myself. But still, like smoke above a blown-out match, you linger in the dimming aftermath, grayer and fainter than a breath. A quiver silvering the once gold air, slowly curling over, but more slowly blurring back to silhouettes, black edges in the rain light, giving shape to aging furniture. Maybe it's less that I have failed to recollect, more that you've risen undetected to the vents, a scent, some facet of me left, unused yet intact, removed but resident, like a clef on empty sheet music inside a closed piano bench. The Beekeeper's Diary. A swarm will surge and stagger from the hive, a spray of gold aluminum each spring. Some colonies must break to stay alive, make way for bodies that a winter brings. Like any matriarchs, old queens contrive to feed and keep the weather from new wings. And so the swarm will drone its discontent, an orchestra tuning its instruments. The bee embodies its pure paradox, fiercely and unself-consciously in turn. A venom cartridge and a honey stock, it trembles between sweetness and the burn of its own thorn. Queen sips the hollyhock's thin nectar and then weightlessly returns to the brood nest. I wonder if she can taste the venom tipping in her glands. I'm going to try to stick to the spirit of brevity that unfortunately pervaded our evening tonight. I condemn you both. I was left wanting, which I suppose is the ideal. I'll read just a few last things. Two, really. This is a poem entitled The Puncture, and it is a pantoum, which, unlike many of the forms we practicing poets receive, is not from medieval Europe in any way. In fact, comes to us from Malaysia. I think its logic will be quite plain within the course of my reading, but suffice it to say that it's sort of one step forward, one step back as it progresses. It winds up reeling in its own way, but I don't think I need to say much more about it. The puncture. A vein is lightning, forked and full. Skin dimples like a sail in wind. Just ease the needle, squeeze and pull. It trampolines beneath the tucked-in pin. Skin dimples like a sail in wind, a curtsy in the softest skirt. It trampolines beneath the tucked-in pin, one worm immersing in its dirt. A curtsy in the softest skirt, a winged thing like a wrinkled gull, one worm immersing in its dirt. Heat swarms encircling one skull. A winged thing, like a wrinkled gull, will sculpt a gust to hug its fringe. Heat swarms encircling one skull. Add water, gunpowder, syringe, will sculpt a gust to hug its fringe. Afloat, below the bone, above, add water, gunpowder, syringe, like waking to the just dreamed of. Afloat, below the bone, above, when wishes wander from the well, like waking to the just dreamed of, the beat slows but repeats itself. When wishes wander from the well, and I sleep more than I should. The beat slows, but repeats itself. A slumber pent within the blood. And I sleep more than I should. Just ease the needle, squeeze and pull. A slumber pent within the blood. A vein is lightning, forked and full. I'll conclude with a sequence. It sounds long. I hope it doesn't feel that way. I've timed it off, and it shouldn't take you very much to live through it. It's entitled Quarantine. It, too, has a circular logic. It's what's known as a crown of sonnets, which means that the first line of the first poem is the last line of the last, and the last line of the first poem, the first line of the second, the last line of the second, the first line of the third. And in this way, it wreathes, hence Corona, which was the original, at least as far as I know, which was John Donne's in the 17th century. This too, I think Duns is the text of a more sure believer. This is a poem I describe as one to the possibility of God. It's organized in accordance with a kind of eccentric view of the liturgical hours, but their sequence, we begin pre-dawn and end after the midnight hour. I won't disclose those. I'll just read it fluidly, front to bottom. Quarantine. Somehow I am sturdier, more sure than sea spray as I thicken through the bedroom door. I gleam of sickness. You give me morning, Lord, as you give earthquake to all architecture. I can forget. You put that sugar in the melon's breath, and it is wet with what you are. I too ferment. You rub the hum and simple warmth of summer from afar into the hips of insects and of everything. I can forget. And like the sea, one more machine without a memory, I don't believe that you made me. I don't believe that you made me into this tremolo of hands, this fever, this flat-footed dance of tendons and the drapery of skin along a skeleton. I am that I am, a brittle ribcage and the hummingbird of breath that flickers in it. Incrementally, I stand. In me are eons and the cramp of endless ancestry. Sun is in the leaves again. I think I see you in the wind, but then I think I see the wind. But then I think I see the wind as an intention, pressing us with weather. All the pieces of the air you've put together somehow know just how to hold the rain. They somehow know to funnel and unfold, to swerve the snow, to rake the beaches, and to slope the arcing seagull's wings. As wind inside a shell, they know you in themselves. I'll find you out. I can know you as a hint in things. I do. And through the window, I have known you as an opening. I have known you as an opening of curtains, as a light blurts through the sky. But this is afternoon, and afternoon is not the time to hunch you with the hot globe of a human eye. So I fluster like a crooked broom in rounds within the living room and try to lift an ear to you. I try. I cut myself into a cave for you. To be a trilling blindness in the infinite vibration of your murmuring July, I cut myself into a cave for you. I cut myself into a cave for you. But you are quiet. You are shy. An only child, you still hide from blame and invitations, and you constantly deny all suitors. I will not be defied. You are the tongue I plunge into this begging razor blade, so brightened by my spider web of blood. You are the one. You are the venom in the serpent I have tried not to become, my Lord. You are the one. My Lord, you are the one. Your breath has blown away the visionary sun and now suffocates the skyline with a dusk. If only once, I wish that you could shudder with my pulse, double over and convulse on the stitches in the skin that I slash wishes in. But Lord, you are the gulf between the hoped for and the happening. You've won. So what is left for me when what is left for me has come? when what is left for me has come, when what is left has left its wing and something slumped against a door, when what is left for me has come to nothing ever after and before this kingdom come to nothing, when what has come is nothing more than what was left, and what was left is nothing more than what has come to nothing ever after and before. If what is left is what is meant for me, and what is meant for me is nothing come to nothing, come to this kingdom come to nothing. To this kingdom come to nothing. I have itemized the night. I have held within the livid tissue of my mouth every particle of light, and even now I am a maze of radiation. I have felt in each of my 100 trillion cells the rapturous, proud swell of darkling sounds whose undulations break a body down to sprays of elemental matter. As well, I have obtained a straightforward account of the forces and conditions that propelled the universe to burst from nothing else, and I can tell of every trembling genesis. There is no end. What has come will come again. There is no end. What has come will come again, will come again, and then distend. And then again. There is no end to origin and. There is again and born again. There is the forming and, the midnight curling into morning and, the glory and again. There is no end. There is the blessing in an and an again. The limitlessly yesing of began begins incessantly again, and then the infinite undressing of all when there is the lifting everything again, the glowing endlessness, and then the floating endlessly again. The floating endlessly again. The glowing and the growing back again as I am, as I can, and I can stand. I understand. Though I am fashioned in the haggard image of a man, I am an atom of the aperture. I am as a nerve inside a gland. I understand. Though I am fashioned as I am a perch for the eternal and a purse for what it lends. I understand. Though flakes of fire overwhelm the fallen snow, though ice caps melt, though oceans freeze or overflow, somehow I am sturdier, more sure. Thank you.
You've been listening to Word Temple on KRCB 91.1 FM. I hope you've enjoyed tonight's program. If you have any questions or comments, please email me at khastings@wordtemple.com. Thanks for listening.